Welcome everyone to Jewish Quest, a podcast produced by the Louis Jacobs Foundation and committed to Rabbi Jacobs' belief that the quest for Torah is itself Torah. My name is Simon Eder, and each week I am joined by a special guest who helps us to deconstruct that week's parasha, exploring new insights and meaning in Torah. And it's wonderful to be joined by our very own director of the Louis Jacobs Foundation, Rabbi Adam Zagoria Moffat, again, who I think last joined us towards the end of Bereshit in this year's cycle. So wonderful to welcome you as we continue our journey through Vayikra this year. Rabbi Adam is, of course, Rabbi of St. Alban's Masorti Synagogue in the UK. He was ordained at JTS in New York, where he also received an MA in Jewish thought. And he also is, of course, the publisher and founder of Izun Books, which continues to pump out some wonderful editions. Rabbi Adam, a very warm welcome back to you as we explore this week Parashat Tzav.
Thanks, Simon. Always good to be here.
So it's obviously encountering in Tzav all these different sacrifices. What do you really make of the multitude of sacrifices that we incur in this week's parasha?
Incur is an interesting word because it does feel in some way like each of them is a diagnostic tool, doesn't it? We meet five korbanot in Tzav. And they're the five basic korbanot of the whole sacrificial system. There are others. There's the tamid offering, which isn't really explored here, the daily offering. There's others as well for special occasions, like the Pesach offering and the sotah offering. But the five that are spelled out here, the olah, the chatat, the mincha, the asham, and the shlamim offering, which we'll talk more about in detail, really, but each of them is generic. It's not for a specific time. It's not for a specific event in one's life. It seems to be actually linked more with emotion rather than anything else. It almost feels like the whole system of korbanot being laid out in Tzav is a very early attempt at a sort of psychology. I think that's what makes it so interesting.
There's a reference that we encounter the concept of the continual fire that's emphasized in Tzav. And I wonder really what you make of it and the sort of symbolism that you might draw from that.
I think we totally underplay our hand when it comes to talking about the symbolism of fire in Judaism. There's a lot of things I think Judaism innovated. And then when other religions borrowed them or had similar ideas, we said, you know what? It's not that important to us anymore. So many things. When Christianity developed and embraced them, we said, yeah, that wasn't anything we wanted anyway. This is rather strange dismissal of previous aspects that were central to Jewish life. And I think perhaps one of the greatest victims of this phenomenon is the centrality of fire as a symbol. The Torah is absolutely riddled with the idea that God is essentially perceived of as fire. Most people wouldn't have to think very hard to come up with some examples. Starting in Bereshit, even the covenant Beina Batarim with Avraham, when there's a description of a smoking oven and a flaming torch, and God appears in this fire, to then, of course, the famous examples of the burning bush, to the examples of Mount Sinai, to God's self identifying. The one descriptor that God consistently uses, I am a consuming fire, a direct reference to the burning bush episode in an interesting paradoxical way. God, of course, appears to the Israelites first and foremost as fire, a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. It is not an exaggeration, I don't think, to say that actually the closest icon we have to seeing what God is fire. And I often have school groups visit the synagogue, and I point to the Ner Tamid, because in the RE curriculum here in the UK, of course, you have certain things that certain classes are always going to cover. And one of them is the Ner Tamid. Kids, even quite small kids, come in 6, 7 years old, and they sit in the synagogue and they raise their hand and they go, oh, where's the perpetual flame? And they have this weirdly sophisticated understanding of the perpetual flame. And I point them to what is actually quite an underwhelming depiction of it in our synagogue, at least, which is a inset, not quite stained glass, but inset element of the arc wall, which has a light bulb behind it that never goes out. The light bulb goes out, but it never goes off. We leave it on all the time. And that's our very diminished version of the Eish Tamid, the Ner Tamid, that we ultimately meet and is described to us in detail in Sav. And I think what's interesting about Sav's description of this is that it's obviously so normal to the book of Vayikra that, of course, God is going to be represented as a flame, and that flame is going to be present all the time. The problem is for us, the reason why I think we don't really embrace this, and the rabbis generally don't talk a great deal about it, is because, of course, Zoroastrianism, which Judaism meets during the Babylonian exile, is obsessed with fire and has at the center of its temples to this day a fire that never goes out. And who influenced who came first? It doesn't really matter. But what's certainly the case is that Judaism starts to ignore that central role for fire once it encounters Zoroastrianism. But it doesn't have to be an aspect of our iconography that we remove, because we have so few icons to begin with. We don't really want to start stripping them away. And I actually think theologically, the fire one is not a bad one to be endorsing and to be recommending.
What a wonderful, all-encompassing answer. I wanted maybe to draw you, just as you mention it, what are the other areas that you feel we have lost to Christianity or others as we have gone on?
I think this is it's a blessing and a curse to be, in many ways, the progenitor of many other faiths, which are bigger and more successful in a purely consumerist way than we are. You know, we've remained largely 15 million people from the time of Leviticus until today, no more, so often less, but no more. And it's shocking in some degree to think that 2/3 of the world is living under a religious system which draws directly from our tradition, and yet we make up only 0.02% of the world. And so I think there's some interesting things that are almost conned, to borrow a rather nerdy term, back onto Judaism. One of them is the idea of the Messiah, which Christianity interprets a particular way. And as a result, we forget what it meant to us, which of course is not a supernatural being, but something much more akin to Aragorn in The Lord of the Rings, the rightful king who's meant to return. There's many that when we encounter Islam, we also changes Jewish thinking. I don't think that Judaism, or rather the Torah, believes that God is omnipotent. It just doesn't seem to be the Peshat at all of the Torah, but Islam very much does. And Judaism post-Islam goes, oh yeah, we think that too, when actually I'm not sure it ever did before that. And there's some work for us to do as modern Jews who now have a healthy distance and respect for our co-religionists, particularly our Abrahamic cousins, for us to do a kind of archaeological intellectual exercise of decolonizing Judaism, of removing those aspects that we did in reaction to others. And part and parcel of that is that fire should be our primary symbol. It's certainly the Torah's primary symbol of God.
I definitely didn't think that we'd get to where we have so far, but you've definitely planted some seeds for the future, and hopefully plenty of further podcasts and gatherings to explore some of the themes that you've just referenced. Let's get back to Tzav. And it does seem that really the role of gratitude and thanksgiving play quite a central role here in the sacrificial system. And I wonder really what you make of these key themes as we explore them here.
I think to go back to something I said a bit earlier, I do think it's about psychology ultimately. And it seems so far from it when we're dealing with the blood and guts and gore of Tzav. But I was really, last year, I read a really interesting book by Mark Solms, who's a famous neuroscientist, and his teacher, a guy named Jak Panksepp, had come up with this idea, which he talks about in detail, and in, I think, a very persuasive manner, that basically there's 7 core emotions that humans experience. And the evidence for this was largely based on faces and facial recognition, and that regardless of one's culture, regardless of one's background, regardless of any degree of education, there are 7 kind of emotions that one can display on their face that can be immediately identified. And I remember really sticking with this idea that there's a core emotional library which we have to draw on. And actually, the Torah doesn't really give emotional language to a lot of these things. But in many ways, when we look at the ways in which these five korbanot, and certainly the others, are used, they do form kind of a basis, in many ways, of emotional attachment, right? The Ola, the Holocaust, to use the Septuagint term, the burnt offering, that which is completely consumed, which goes up in smoke. One of Pachsep's categories was seeking, that one of the essential emotions we have is expectation, looking to other people and waiting for a response. And certainly this idea of giving up the entirety of an animal to smoke is our way of asking God for a response. And two, the more predictable emotions like grief and sadness, we have the chatat offering, that we express our regret over our actions when they can't be made right. We have something we can do. It's actually really healthy to have something you can do when you have a sense of grief that you don't have anywhere to put. Similarly, there's an interpersonal component, the mincha offering, the only vegetarian one in the list, in which is basically a quite tasty sounding cake that's being produced for the sake of the priests, express this emotion of care, right? It's our way of feeding the priests and looking after them and having a sense of shared food. They would have shared the food with each other and with those who brought the sacrifice. You could go on and try and think about what do these five categories represent emotionally, but I don't think it's too difficult to map them onto some idea of basic emotional states and to recognize that the Torah is offering us a rubric of ritual, which allows us to externalize psychological need in ritual action. And I'm not bewailing the lack of sacrifices in Judaism today. I'm quite satisfied that I no longer have to worry about preparing all of these animals for their untimely deaths. But I do think that we're missing something in not having rituals to meet these same emotional needs, because they do serve a purpose. And Leviticus in general, and certainly Tzav specifically, recognizes the way in which these actions are not just for God's sake, maybe not at all for God's sake, but are for the sake of the emotional needs of the people who bring them.
We'll maybe come back to how we can further internalize our reading for today. I wonder, though, if we might just dwell briefly on the relationship between Moses and Aaron that we encounter here, and as to whether or not you see a kind of development in their relationship as we dwell on these passages versus earlier on in their evolution.
That's interesting, because of course those who come to synagogue regularly know what's going to happen next week, right? And know how the relationship between Moses and Aaron is about to break in some way, in a fundamental way that's not going to be repaired. And yet, here we already see in some way the division and the separation of Aaron from his brother, in particular in the end of the parasha, when we have a detailed description of how the priests are to be ordained. I find it absolutely fascinating. I think usually when we read Tzav, especially because it tends to fall on a special Shabbat, by the time we get to the seventh Aliyah, no one's paying a great deal of attention, myself included. But the ordination of the priest, the ritual that involves, is stunningly interestingly, because it introduces, not for the first time, but in a fundamental way, this idea of 7 days, something that will become fundamental to Rabbinic Judaism, the idea of a 7-day period. And what really strikes me is that in some way I feel, and again, I'm retconning the Torah myself, which I criticized others for a moment ago, but in some way we are not only being foreshadowed, but actually almost time traveling, because Aaron is sitting. Think about what Aaron's doing at the end of the parasha. He's sitting for 7 days in his tent. He's not allowed to leave. Other people are bringing him food. He's sitting Shiva a week before his sons die, because on the last day of that 7-day period, when the tabernacle is inaugurated, that's when Nadav and Avihu die. And so you have this bizarre pre-death Shiva ritual that seems to appear. And it's a really interesting moment to me, because of course that 7-day period not only becomes Shiva for us as rabbinic Jews in mourning, but we have its reflection in so many other aspects. We have 7 days of mourning after death. We have 7 days of celebration after a wedding, 7 days of panim chadashot and sheva brachot. We have 7 days of creation in Genesis, and 7 days here of the creation of the priesthood, of this creation of a social entity, which is going to be forever separated, not just from the Levites more broadly, represented by Moses, who remains a Levite and not a Kohen, but also by Aaron and his own choices and his children, the ones that survive and the ones that don't.
No, fascinating dwelling on that. And thank you for planting that seed for next week as well. Maybe to go back then just to the sacrifices, and you've painted the kind of psychological picture of the way in which we might read them. But I wonder really further if you could maybe unpack how, as we continue this quest through Vayikra, how we might continue to interpret and understand these sacrifices as we internalize them for our own spiritual purposes, perhaps for today.
I think it's something which, in order to really understand, we have to go far outside our comfort zone, especially as modern, largely Western, largely European-minded folks. The sacrifices are essentially magic, and magic is always about exchange. You give something up, a sacrifice in its purest sense, which of course doesn't correspond to the Hebrew word behind all of this, and in exchange you get something in return, a change to the world around you, a change to yourself. Usually the two are often understood to be the same thing. And I guess there's something to be said for actually looking at these descriptions and seeing them as essentially magical rituals. The things that are being given up, whether it's the valuable flour that's been sifted at the mill, or whether it's the animal that's prized from the herd, particularly some very expensive ones like bulls, they are of great value, not just financially, but also emotionally. And it is in the surrender of that thing which is wanted, which actually gains not only divine favor, whatever that means, but a certain degree of psychological and emotional fulfillment. And it seems quite counterintuitive, but I would say and encourage people to see this in the context of shamanism worldwide, of magical systems worldwide, of the kind of thinking about power and sacrifice and giving up what's desired, which is ultimately behind so many of the world's most ancient religions. What's interesting about Leviticus is it gives us a way to do that's really safe compared to the alternatives. We're not harming ourselves. These aren't blood-spilling rituals, of which were so common. We're not harming other people, which would have been the assumption in the ancient world and many of its magical systems. Not even the ancient world, in much of the fairly modern world, there were so many cultural aspects that permitted and encouraged the sacrifice of humans in one way or another, symbolically or literally. The Torah is taking that impulse, the magical power exchange that happens from giving up things you want and asking for other things that you want, and is giving it a ritual which allows it to be circumscribed and protected, while also protecting the people who partake in it. And while it's not the ritual that we do today, we should, I think, try to translate the method and the mechanics of these sacrifices to our own sort of magical workings today, whatever that might look like. And I think that language probably is terrifying to a lot of people and certainly feels woefully un-Jewish in many ways. But again, that's one of those things where we should maybe question our assumptions about what's Jewish rather than question our assumptions about how to read the Torah. Because the Torah pretty much tells us straightforwardly what it believes about the system that it's describing in Leviticus. And it's not shy about suggesting that ultimately it is an exchange. You give up what you want. You watch it burn up, you watch it be killed, you give it to the priests, and in exchange, what you want, whether that's forgiveness or peace or wholeness or a lack of grief or an contact with God or a relief from guilt, is given to you by God in exchange. There's something to it. There's something to it that we do not do ourselves a service if we simply look at it and think of it as primitive or in some way outdated, because although the particular rituals might be outdated, and I'm pleased they are, the method is not.
And so many modern rituals or practices, therapies that have evolved to replace this is what really came to mind in when you were speaking.
Yeah, and I think what people will find who have encountered these experiences of transformation, whether they call it magical or not, doesn't really matter, is that the more that's at stake, the more profound it is. And that reflects the essential mechanic behind the korbanot, that by releasing desire, by giving up what's wanted, you bring yourself close to God. You initiate a process of assimilation in a quite literal sense of becoming nearer to God. And that is certainly something which we can learn from in a world which values so much getting what you want and hoarding what you want and never giving it up, to try and change that and flip that script and say, no, there's something to be said for giving up the thing you want most, is a rather hard pitch to make. But ultimately, that's what confronts us when we sit down and read Leviticus every year.
And I think that's also a wonderful segue into next week, when we read about Nadav and Avihu, and look forward to that. Rabbi Adam, thank you so much for joining us today and your wonderful exploration, as ever, which has taken us so much wider than just Sav. But of course, we have explored that with you wonderfully. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Simon.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please do remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can find out more about our information on our sites, louisjacobs.org and also jewishquest.org. Do tune in again next week as we continue our quest together.